Well, there are two current state events I'd like to remind you about real quickly before we get into the program here today. Saturday, maybe you're aware, we have broadcast from the East Lansing Art Festival ever since we were a program 3 years ago, and we'll be back between 11 and 12. It's an all-live music hour happening in front of East Lansing City Hall with Current State. We hope you can stop by. Catbird Seat, Moxie Strings, and other bands performing live in that hour from 11 a.m. until 12 o'clock noon in front of East Lansing City Hall. And 1 week from tonight, our next pop-up stories event happens at the Robin Theater in Rio Town, The Birds and the Bees. And if you have a story relating to The Birds and the Bees, basically family-friendly, please check out our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. You can connect with us at currentstate@wkar.org. That's also another way to connect. And whether you have a story or not, you're certainly invited to stop by. 1 week from tonight, 6 p.m., at the Robin Theater in Rio Town. Well, have you ever wished that America's political discourse were more civil? Many feel the country's descended into name-calling and finger-pointing, and that much of the conversation never rises above that anymore. Two of Michigan's leading political analysts are uniting to try to do something about that. Susan Demas is the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. She has a liberal perspective. Kathy Hoekstra is the owner of Kathy Hoekstra Communications. She's a conservative who has a background working for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy and the presidential campaign of Herman Cain. Together, they are forming the Two Chicks Speakers Bureau. They've begun to seek out joint speaking engagements to discuss the political issues of the day where they can disagree without being disagreeable. We are expecting Kathy Hoekstra to blow through the door any moment here, but for now, I'll welcome Susan Demas back to Current State. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Mark.
We'll get into some of the hot political issues of the day, but we should spend a moment talking. Let's talk about your friendship with Kathy Hoekstra when she isn't in the room and there's no one listening. It's just you and me here, Susan. How did you and Kathy get to know each other?
You know, actually, it's kind of a modern story. We got to know each other on Facebook, of all places. Mm. Kathy lives up in Saginaw. I'm down here in the Lansing area. And so with busy schedules and kids, we may have never run into each other. But, you know, we've really enjoyed getting to know each other personally and occasionally tangling politically. So mm-hmm. It's fun.
Now, she has a rather well-known last name, but you were telling me that she is no relation to Congressman Pete Hoekstra?
No, she's often mistaken as his daughter, but no, she is not. We're both the daughters of accountants who were not very well-known.
How did you, both daughters of accountants?
Yes.
Is that right? How did you discover that you could debate the issues with Kathy and still get along and not have to suffer that tension that we often suffer when we're alone with somebody of the opposite political persuasion?
Well, honestly, you know, through some of the social media interactions, you know, she will post on issues and I will. And unlike some of the other people in our friend circles, you know, we could disagree without trying to kill each other. And that's why I thought she would be a really good fit for the Pundit Summit that Inside Michigan Politics sponsors every couple years with public sector consultants. She was on a panel that I moderated, and it was just a lot of fun.
Mm. Now, you've appeared on Off the Record with Tim Skubick. Has Kathy been on the program as well?
Yes, for the Bloggers Edition.
Oh, okay. Now, last week, you announced this joint venture that you're calling the Two Chick Speakers Bureau. How is this going to work, and what's the early response been to it?
You know, we've been delighted at the response. A lot of people are interested, you know, from groups across the state. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun for us. And, you know, we just thought that it would be great to join forces. I mean, frankly, I've been doing public speaking for about a decade. There aren't a lot of women on the circuit, especially to talk about politics. Kathy and I are pretty lonely out there. And we have different backgrounds, different perspectives. But, you know, we have a lot of fun together because we know each other. And, you know, we had a lot of chemistry and the couple events that we've done together. And so, you know, it was kind of a kismet idea. Mm. And I think it's going to work out great.
And in a general election year, no less, unlike any other general election year than anyone has ever seen before. How perfect is that?
Absolutely.
All kinds of opportunities here, too. And there is Kathy Hoekstra walking through the door. We are talking with Susan Demas, and we're about to check in here with Kathy Hoekstra. They both spent their careers covering politics from the left and from the right, and they have forged a friendship despite their differing viewpoints. Together, they have started the Two Chicks Speaker Bureau for joint appearances to discuss political issues. Kathy Hoekstra, welcome to Current State.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much.
Blow through the door. We sit you down at a microphone, and we start asking you questions.
Oh, go for it. That's fine.
There's not a second to lose here. Let's talk about, well, let's get you, I don't know if you were able to hear Susan's comments here as you were en route. You probably were not here because you had to take some stairs and an elevator and all kinds of walk through the hallway for a little while here. Give us your take on working with Susan on this Two Chicks initiative.
Oh, I'm really excited about it. When Susan was actually the one who sort of pitched the idea after we served on a panel together back in February, and we just when we did this panel discussion, I knew it would be a lot of fun. And I think the way that we were able to sort of feed off each other and have fun, there was no, even though we are one person on the left, one person on the right sort of a thing, it complemented each other rather than contrasted with each other in a negative way. And when we were done, we went out and we sat down and, you know, shared a little beverage and thought, wow, this was really, it was a good feel.
Positive
it was a
chemistry.
Good thing. It was good chemistry. And as Susan said in the news release, you know, we have a lot of similarities, and approaching them sometimes from a philosophically different sides, I think is just, it's an amazing dynamic. And I think people will be very receptive and very responsive and very interested in what we have to say.
Well, let's talk about let's jump into some of the issues here, because it is the day after yet another primaries for both presidential candidates in Oregon and for the Democrats in Kentucky. Talk to us briefly, Susan, about the two main candidates here, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Sanders has won Oregon. Hillary Clinton is claiming victory in Kentucky, but it's officially still, as we are here this morning, a little too close to call here. Susan, what are your thoughts on another Sanders win, first of all?
Well, Oregon was expected to go for Sanders. He needed to do better to indicate that he had a real shot in California, which is probably what this race is going to come down to. So I think we all know that Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee, even if she limps into it. You know, you have a divided party right now, and it remains to be seen if Hillary Clinton can consolidate support. Donald Trump has done a pretty good job on the Republican side. That's why you're seeing the polls be pretty close between Clinton and Trump. We'll see if that happens for the Democrats. It usually does, but this is an unusual year.
To what extent do you think this becomes about California now at this point? I think there's even though the math still clearly favors Hillary Clinton, the prospect of a Sanders victory in California, I find pretty intriguing to win a state that big. What do you think, Kathy?
I agree. And I think what might happen if we do see, no matter what happens in California, I think we are going to see some faction of the Democrat Party and supporters of Sanders insisting on revisiting the superdelegate rule that the Democrat Party or the Democratic Party put in, because that's what's really helping Hillary Clinton along. It's the commitments from the superdelegates. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the Sanders camp and others who simply you know, do not want to see Hillary Clinton take the nomination, really go after that. And it maybe, you know, after the fact, I agree with Susan. I think we are going to see a Hillary Clinton as the nominee for president. But I do think there are going to be challenges within the Democratic Party.
But Kathy, what about the Republican convention as well? Because there is still talk of a compromise Republican candidate to try to shore up divisions triggered by a Donald Trump candidacy. Could that happen as well?
You know, if you would have asked me this a couple of months ago, I would have said there's a greater chance of it. But I think what we are seeing on the Republican side is a greater effort within the party and some of the party leaders to really try to shore up more support for a Donald Trump campaign and presidency. I mean, you had him meeting with Paul Ryan, of all people. It doesn't make certain, you know, farther right folks happy about it, but that's what you're seeing. And even here in Michigan, you had Lieutenant Governor Calley doing a similar thing. You know, hey, guys, we need to get behind this candidate, you know. And so I don't think Cleveland, the National Republican National Convention in Cleveland, is going to be hot. It'll be interesting, but I don't think it's going to be as earth-shattering as it may have been a few months ago when we still had a viable Ted Cruz in the race.
You think Donald Trump takes it on the first ballot?
Probably. I don't have my crystal ball, but he may. If the momentum keeps going the way it has been with people getting behind Donald Trump, whether it is reluctantly, whether it is, you know, by holding their nose, or whether it is just throwing support behind Trump for an anti-Clinton, but whatever the reason, if this momentum continues, probably first ballot.
Are you on board with Donald Trump?
With me, I feel as if I have to be, but I'm going to kind of hold back and see how the campaigns go and how the polling all goes and see how close Michigan is when it comes to the time to actually pull the ballot in November.
Talk to us, Susan, about your thoughts and your feelings about the two main Democratic candidates. How have you felt all along about Hillary Clinton? How do you assess Bernie Sanders' success in sticking this out and the successes he has enjoyed?
I think that Sanders has run a remarkable campaign. I mean, you know, he started from nothing and his crowds are incredibly impressive. He's definitely captured the hearts and minds of young voters and the far left. I think what we've seen through this process, because Hillary Clinton has several million more votes, and she's got about 300 more pledged delegates, not even with the superdelegates, is that the Sanders faction of the Democratic Party is still a minority within the party. But that's where the growth can be. And the Democratic Party, I think, will have a reckoning at some point, as the Republican Party is right now. What kind of party do you want to be? Do you want to continue to be a center-left party? Do you want to shift to the left? And I think we'll see that play out in the future.
What do you make of what's going on the GOP side, Susan?
I think that it's a remarkable election. I mean, certainly nobody wanted to call it for Donald Trump last year. You know, really for me, one of the defining moments was when he was up in Kathy's neck of the woods, up in Saginaw Birch Run, and he had just such an electric response. He's really captured the Republican base. I think in a way that current office holders were taken aback from, and they're struggling to do so. And so that's why you see a lot of the office holders like Brian Kelly reluctantly get on board, because, you know, clearly Trump has tapped into something that some sort of enthusiasm that they have not.
Isn't that something Trump and Bernie Sanders share, though, really, Kathy Hoekstra?
That's exactly what I was going to remark on. And to Susan's point about the Trump event in Birch Run, I actually emceed that evening event. It was the Genesee County and Saginaw County's Republican parties joining together for a Lincoln Day event up at the Birch Run Expo Center, which is my neck of the woods. So I was asked to emcee the event. So I got to see firsthand, you know, I had a front row seat after all my MC duties were done. I had a first row, a firsthand view to witness this Trump phenomenon. And again, that was back in August. So it was really sort of new to me and very remarkable to
That's
see
forever
him.
Ago.
It was
August,
forever
it's May.
Ago. But it was remarkable, so remarkable to see him, how the crowd, how the audience reacted to him, how he was able to play. He's a master of being able to read an audience and respond to them and get them excited. Bernie Sanders, same way. I have my two younger brothers live out in Eugene, Oregon, and they both, they're not necessarily themselves feeling the burn, but they're just sort of sitting back watching, and they're on the left too. Both of my brothers are, but sitting back going, wow, this guy's just sort of sweeping in and drawing out so many people, and he's the buzz of, and obviously Eugene, Oregon is very similar to Ann Arbor in terms of its demographics and you know, pretty much the political bent out there. So yeah, very, very similar, both gentlemen, of the what they have been able to tap into within their respective party bases.
We're talking with Kathy Hoekstra and Susan Demas, who have just recently formed the Two Chicks Speakers Bureau. They will be making joint appearances to discuss political issues. Let's focus in here on Michigan's next gubernatorial race. The two most mentioned likely candidates would be Attorney General Bill Schuette for the Republicans and former State Senator Gretchen Whitmer for the Democrats. Susan, do you anticipate these two as the likely candidates?
It is so incredibly early, but if I were to make a prediction at this point, I would say the nominees would be Schuette for the Republicans and Congressman Dan Kildee Flint
okay.
for the Democrats.
Gretchen Whitmer was on this program here earlier this week and sounded as if she was strongly inclined to make a bid here. Kathy, what do you make of those two choices on the Democratic side?
I agree with Susan. I do see Dan Kildee on the ballot before I would see Gretchen Whitmer. However, interestingly enough, in reading over some of the Capitol publications, MERS in particular, from yesterday, it brought up an interesting point that I had not thought about. You know, Dan Kildee is really thrust into the spotlight because of the Flint water situation, right? But the piece that I read very quickly raised the possibility of could Kildee possibly overplay his hand. And I hadn't thought about that before because running for governor, you not only have to appeal to the people of Flint in Genesee County, but you have, you know, the entire state. And is there a possibility that perhaps Congressman Kildee's, could take things too far and really have shore up people on the other side?
This is a conversation that we have got to continue, but I regret to say we are out of time. We've been talking with the two women behind the Two Chicks Speakers Bureau, Kathy Hoekstra and Susan Demas. Susan publishes the Inside Michigan Politics newsletter. Kathy Hoekstra runs Kathy Hoekstra Communications. Together, they're bringing collegiality to the political perspectives of the left and the right. Imagine that. Where can they learn more about your availability?
If you go to SusanJDemas.com or
KathyHoekstra.com.
Very good. Easy. Thank you for joining us, and we will have you back.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, Mid-Michigan is home to some 700 refugees. That number could rise in the future if the region receives part of an expected wave of Syrians coming to the U.S. Our Neighbors in Action segment this week does not focus on a volunteer-driven nonprofit. Instead, we'll hear the dream of one local man who'd like to see an East Lansing student apartment complex become a home for arriving refugees. Tens of thousands of Michigan State University students have left campus life behind in recent days. They've also left behind tons of stuff. Furniture, food, carpeting, bikes, clothing, lots more. Yesterday, I visited the store to check out this year's haul. That's the MSU surplus store, of course. I started our tour at the rear loading dock with the store's communications director, James Ives.
This is our dock area. This is where the trucks would come in multiple, several times a day during move-out. And as you can see, the material is still coming out. We triage it, so to say, in Gaylord boxes. We empty it out here. We process it. A lot of it went to our another building to where we could store it, just because we don't have that much room to store it all here. But once it's here, we'll further process it, excuse me, and then get ready to put it out on the sales floor for sale, as well as, you know, recycle what we can, or unfortunately we have to landfill some of it.
So you've estimated between 70,000 and 80,000 pounds of carpet, is that right?
Yes, pretty amazing, isn't it?
How do you arrive at that number?
We weigh it all. I mean, we weigh everything that came in. You know, we would at first just weigh the racks that they would come in. And then, you know, we just got an average of about 10 or 20 of those. And then we just kind of kept track of how many were to come in.
What percentage of your total inventory has just come in, though, here in the past week or so?
For as much as we have, it's still only maybe 5% of our total inventory.
But this must be one of your busiest periods, isn't it, right after the students leave?
Yes. Move out and move in are the two busiest weeks of the year. It's pretty much all hands on deck those 2 weeks.
Do you hire more people to sift through all this stuff?
No, actually, we did not, and that's kind of our goal. We did it with what we have, but like I said, it is all hands on deck. Even I was helping unload trucks. We had people from the office, you know, just helping out in any way they can, going out onto campus. Oh, it's pretty taxing on all of us, but yet it's pretty exciting.
Do you get more customers as a result of this activity here right after move out and right during move in?
Yes, we do. With the social marketing and the other pieces that I've picked up from the media, I was just talking to the staff up front in the store. They were saying it's like a Friday. Fridays are typically more busy for whatever reason, but it's Tuesday, and it is extremely busy. Yeah, we do. And we're hoping to get more students in the fall from some of the items that we've collected, because it'll probably take us that long to go through it all.
Overall, is this a good thing, or would you prefer students leave less stuff behind?
Well, one of our main goals here, our main function of this unit, is landfill diversion. And we're shooting for zero waste eventually down the road. So it would be great if they could take everything home with them. You know, it's good that what we're doing, you know, we're diverting 40% this year from the landfill, and that's 15% higher than last year. But if we had less to deal with, as far as to process, it would just mean less out of the landfill.
You think you'll ever outgrow this location? You ever expect so much stuff in here that you may not have room for at all here?
We already did the first year, yeah, absolutely. It just comes in waves, but yeah, it's kind of like when you build a pole barn, it's never too big.
What's the strangest thing you've ever put out on the floor here, or that's ever passed through this place?
Mark, a lot of people ask that question. When you work here for a few years, or as long as I have, it's hard to see the strange, because there's just so many oddities. I mean, it's, you know, we've had skeletons of horse legs. We've had an antique bear rug. You know, so odd, strange, it kind of all runs together.
It's all relative here at the surplus store, is that it?
Oh, absolutely. It depends on the day, too.
What's the most valuable thing that someone has ever, that's ever come through the store that someone has left behind?
Well, now if you say students, it's kind of hard to say, because the clothing, there's some pretty valuable pieces of clothing. Bikes, there's some pretty valuable bikes. Some jewelry, even some books. You know, there's some books that have a good value to them.
Does a lot of food end up coming here?
Yes. So far we've collected about 5,000 pounds of food, which will be what can be used still, will be donated to a local charity. It's part of the Pack Up Pitch-In. We call it Poopy, if you will, Pack Up Pitch-In. It's partnership with the residence halls, RHS, here on campus. It's a great partnership, and they coordinate it with the students. And rather than them going right into the landfill, it's just another opportunity for diversion and for the local communities.
You mentioned all the clothing you come into. How much have you come into in the last few days?
So far, about 17,000 pounds. And we will sell what we can here at the surplus store to offset some of the landfill costs and the collection costs. But what we can't sell, we'll also donate to other local charities as well.
Do you weigh just about everything, or at least everything that comes in mass quantities?
Yes, we do. Tracking is a very hard thing to do in this business, so one thing we rely on a lot is weights.
You've actually got a number of the total number of pounds of items that have come in here. What is that number?
We have, to date, about 655,000 pounds of material. And as I showed you earlier, it's still coming in. There's some still late move-outs. A lot of international students stay a little longer. So we're still collecting a lot of the material. Not a lot, but some of the material. So 655,000 and counting.
When's it going to slow down again?
Oh, it already has compared to move-out week, believe me. But it'll probably slow down come winter.
James Ives is Education Outreach Coordinator here at the MSU Surplus Store. Have a great summer. Nice visiting with you.
Yes, thanks, Mark. Stop by anytime.
And coming up on Current State, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra just signed Timothy Muffet for another 3-year contract. We'll speak with the maestro and learn more about the recently announced 2016-17 season. That and more after the break. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us today. Every week, Current State's Neighbors in Action segment highlights the work of a volunteer-driven organization working to make a difference in Lansing or mid-Michigan. This week, the segment is a little different. An Okemos man wants to create an organization over a cause he feels passionately about. Mid-Michigan is home to about 700 refugees from countries like Bosnia, Turkey, and Iraq. Providing the material support they need is always a challenge, and that includes housing. Tom Dye has fond memories of his time living in MSU's Spartan Village apartments, and he thinks the complex would be a great place to welcome refugees to their new lives in America. I spoke with Tom Dye about his idea. We were joined by Dr. Farha Abbasi, an assistant professor of psychiatry at MSU, known for her study of the mental health of immigrants and refugees. I first asked Tom Dye why Spartan Village should be repurposed as refugee housing.
The idea got started when I learned that Spartan Village Apartments was going to shift their housing to other areas and that the apartments would be closed. And it made me think of what a unique place Spartan Village is. 40 years ago, I came to Spartan Village to teach and also to bring my family to learn and live there. It recreated my family, and it recreated all of those families who were around me. There was an experience, a shared experience, that we became open to each other and as a result changed.
That's what you mean when you say it recreated your family?
Yeah, one of the things that I did while I was there that I had the good fortune to do was I worked on a mathematics and hypermedia project, which was to explore student understanding. And from that experience, we looked at children on a longitudinal study. And we found that those children were very successful because they were more open to exploration of ideas, because they judged things not so much on the outside, but on the inside. And an anthropologist named Ruth Asim first talked to us at Spartan Village Elementary when I got there about how being here allows families to recreate themselves, to feel safe, to feel nurtured, and to feel wanted, to give people hope. And that's something that I think is unique to Spartan Village Apartments history, is the idea of hope.
Farha Abbasi, last month you participated in a refugee symposium here at MSU. Your presentation focused on building an integrative model for refugee resettlement. What do you think of what Tom is proposing?
Mark, I'm myself an immigrant, a new American, but I feel I was Spartan forever. What's happening is when the refugees are finally resettled, they are settled in locations which are not in healthy environments. Like what Tom is saying, that if you want them to recreate themselves or integrate into the culture, you need to provide them a safe, secure, and healthy environment. So I was also thinking, like, what if we have this model where federal agencies combined with the academic universities, because academic universities have all these facilities. They can train these refugees. They can provide mental health, physical health. They can train them, teach them vocational abilities. So that's why I think it was an ideal setup when Tom started talking about this integrative project. And that's the model I already was promoting, that community stakeholders, federal agencies and the academic universities should come together, pool these their resources, and develop these models.
We're talking today about a proposed plan to create residential units and services for 10 refugee families at Spartan Village Apartments on the Michigan State University campus. My guests are Dr. Farha Abbasi, assistant professor of psychiatry here at MSU. Also with me, Tom Dye, a proponent of refugee housing here in East Lansing. Tom, you're envisioning a college or a department here at MSU essentially supervising volunteers who would work with the refugees on a regular basis. Tell us more about what you have in mind.
To my knowledge, no university is providing housing for refugees. Now, Spartan Village is unique in a number of ways. In the first way, many of the complexes are in the shape of a C. So when you go into the complex, you see your neighbors, you hear your neighbors, you smell what your neighbors are cooking. You're not isolated. You're part of a community. And in many of those apartments, there's a shared playground. So young people then have a chance to play together, and parents have a chance to play together and be together. Then you have a shared laundry. So the laundry, again, is another opportunity to communicate and not be an isolate. Along in Spartan Village, there's a community center. Refugees come with, just as we do, with different needs. It's important for a person to take strength from their culture. A community center offers that. Also, there's the idea of having a central place for our care agencies to be able to deliver services to that population and thus save time. There's also something that Michigan has, which is a unique history, and that's their success with students of international cultures. And there's a special term for it at MSU. But they do a unique job of helping those students to navigate and translate in order to be successful at the college. Navigation through social services and translation are very important. And Michigan State has a strong history in that, along with a powerful transportation system that is close by. You have a bus hub, you have a train station, and then on top of that, you have a number of faith organizations which are very close to those residents.
Spartan Village is set to close next year. How can you get this thing moving faster or sooner as opposed to later?
I think two things are necessary. One is that a college within the university would be willing to provide an advisor, a faculty member to supervise services, to supervise volunteers. That is one issue. Another issue is money. The search for public and private funds. Why money is so confusing to me is that currently there are 500,000 deportation cases that are pending. We have 33,000 people today in cells awaiting deportation proceedings at a cost of $120 per cell. We spend money for incarceration, but we're not spending money for rejuvenation.
Farha, is there an educational opportunity here for the university that would make sense to get MSU involved in this?
Absolutely, Mark. So first thing I realized as an immigrant that teachers do become the first responders to the new immigrants that come into the country. And a lot of responsibility comes on the teachers to help them navigate the system. So think of it in the terms of Michigan State University. We do have two medical schools here, and we do send these medical students to get, they travel and to work with these refugee population. So this will be a unique chance for the medical students to have come in contact with this population. Other thing is, think of education department, business department. You have social work department. You have psychiatry department. So I'm a psychiatry faculty, and what we are doing is we are already working on a similar project in Jordan, with where we will, Michigan State will collaborate with the local stakeholders to develop a refugee rehabilitation center where social services would be provided, educational, vocational, and mental health and physical health services would be provided.
What's next in the process, Tom?
Well, that's the difficulty, is where we take our next step. If the university would help to look at grant writing to see if there are opportunities to bring in federal and private money to begin a small study and to see if that could be expanded. It's hard because refugees receive financial aid for 3 months. And in after that time, then they have, they're responsible then, and which I don't have the knowledge base to explain what that means to a family because I haven't experienced it, of making contacts, for example, with the Chamber of Commerce, Lansing Community College, which is just down the street, about finding where areas of needs for jobs are so people can be directed towards those and that they can be embraced in the community monetarily as well as emotionally.
Farha, given those challenges here, what do you think of the prospects here?
So it's sad that when we talk about refugee health or refugee integration process, we inadvertently are promoting impermanence and insecurity instead of working towards making them feel at home and making them viable citizens. So my hope is that we are able to generate more interest in this. One thing is, what comes first? Does the funding come first and the project and the university participation comes later, or is it going to be university participation come first and then we go look for funding through the federal agencies? But I have been talking to some federal agencies as well. So the funding is there. I do think this is a very unique idea, which, and also a very viable and mutually beneficial project.
We've been talking about a proposed plan to create housing and related services for 10 refugee families at Spartan Village Apartments on the MSU campus. My guests have been Dr. Farha Abbasi, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Michigan State University. Also with me, Tom Dye, a proponent of the plan for refugee housing at Spartan Village Apartments. Thank you both and good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out. Mail us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State. Tell us a little bit, please, about why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Last week, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra released details about next season's concerts, as well as information about the contract with their music director, Timothy Muffett. Maestro Muffett visited WKAR yesterday and spoke with classical music host Jody Knoll.
Timothy Muffett, congratulations on completing your 10th season with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you. It's been a great 10 years.
Well, you apparently passed your probationary period because they extended your contract for 3 years, right?
Right. They're letting the leash out just a little bit at a time, yes.
Well, how has the Lansing Symphony Orchestra changed over these past 10 years?
Well, as an organization, I feel that we've really come into focus in all parties involved. I feel like our mission, way of doing things, our priorities have really have clarified. And that would go across the board.
Well, you have a mix of soloists for the upcoming season, some big names like pianist Jeremy Denk and guitarist Sharon Isbin, as well as some equally talented musicians with Lansing connections who we'll talk about in just a bit. It seems obvious to me that the bigger the name of the soloist, the more expensive they would be.
That's correct.
Do bigger name artists bring more people to the concerts to help offset that?
Yes. There certainly is a box office bump. It's not as quite as easily translatable as that. I feel like in some ways a rising tide lifts all the boats, in that when the Lansing Symphony is, in our general listening area, the people who know the names in classical music, if that person sees, oh, there's Sharon Isbin with the Lansing Symphony, that might resonate a little more deeply anytime the Lansing Symphony shows up. So I do feel that, yes, there's some immediate, we would expect with these bigger name artists to see some immediate bump at the box office, but I also feel like it carries a little bit further down the road. And then it also, you know, it's in the bigger picture of things, people looking at the community of Lansing from the outside see, wow, well, they have a symphony there, and that symphony is able to present some of the greatest artists in the world. And that speaks well for our city as a place to live and to do business.
Well, let's talk about some of the specific concerts and soloists. And why don't we start with one of the big names that I just mentioned on the fall schedule. The season opener in September features guest pianist Jeremy Denk playing Ravel's Concerto in D for piano, left hand, and orchestra. I'm curious why the Ravel and why the concerto for left hand alone?
Well, this was actually a work that Mr. Denk had suggested, and it's one of the masterpieces of the 20th century, and having an artist of his stature seemed like a great way to open the season. And I immediately with that, you know, it's there are two elements at work in the Ravel. There's a little bit of a jazz inspiration, but what I wanted to pick up on was the echoes of Impressionism of Ravel, and plan a program of Ravel and his contemporaries, all of whom kind of lock into that that impression, echo of Impressionism, as I said. So we've got Manuel de Falla and Respighi, and then of course the grandmaster of musical Impressionism, Debussy.
For the November concert, the orchestra will be joined by a couple of hundred guest artists.
Right.
When the MSU Choral Ensembles team up with the LSO for the Beethoven Ninth. I don't think you've done the Beethoven Ninth since you've been in Lansing, have
No.
you?
No, and we're very much looking forward to it.
Yeah.
That's obviously a work that has great appeal for everyone involved. It's always an exciting undertaking.
Masterworks 3 in January of 2017 will be a homecoming for Cleveland Orchestra cellist Tanya L., an Okemos native. She last appeared with the LSO as part of a trio of soloists in the Beethoven Triple Concerto.
Right. We've asked her virtually every year since then.
And oh, really?
This is the first time that she's been able to make it work. She's very busy, as you might imagine, playing with one of the greatest orchestras on the planet, the Cleveland Orchestra. She's such a wonderful cellist and musician, and then to have the hometown connection is big as well. So this is a program. She'll play the Dvorak Concerto with us, and that is the centerpiece of the program.
Perhaps the biggest name of the season in terms of guest artists is guitarist Sharon Isbin, who will be on the February concert, and she'll play one of the most popular guitar concertos ever written. And it's one of my favorites, I have
sure.
to say.
Well, you know, this kind of went back and forth on this one, and then we thought, well, let's go with the slam dunk approach. And then we planned a kind of, I'm very excited about this program, which is sort of from from Spain to the Americas. So she will play a piece of Spanish music, the Rodrigo Concerto Aranjuez, which is that work you mentioned. It's easily the most popular guitar concerto.
In March, you have a Russian program which features MSU College music violin professor Dmitry Berlinsky playing the lyrical and succinct violin concerto by Alexander Glazunov.
Yes, his best work, without a doubt. The Glazunov Concerto is just such a beautifully inspired piece of music, and it's exactly what you said. I laugh when you use those words because it is not sprawling. However, it's totally satisfying. It's like eating a high-protein meal where, you know, it's just completely, it's really a magnificent work, and not all of Glazunov's music falls into that category. I've been wanting to do something with Dmitry, you know, who, yes, he just happens to live here in the Lansing area, but he's also one of the greatest violinists around working today. So I've been wanting to do something with him, and I was secretly hoping it would be Glazunov. And when we had a conversation, it was literally a conversation in the hallway. We just had run into each other, and I say, I've been meaning to call you. And I said, what would you want to play? And the first thing he said was Glazunov. And so that was
really
the end of the discussion.
Wow. I bet it's not always that easy.
It's not. It's not. And of course, you know, I'd love to hear Dmitry play any number of things, but especially music from the Russian composers, and especially this work, I think I'm really excited. So we have an all-Russian program.
The final Masterworks concert of the season in May sees the third return of Lisa Pager, percussionist.
Right.
And she's going to be joining the LSO for a world premiere.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, it came about because after the first and second performances of Lisa Pager, people kept saying, when is Lisa Pager coming back again? And she is
an exciting performer.
She's a very exciting performer. And a percussion concerto is just such an all-encompassing event from the audience perspective.
A visual.
Right, a visual.
As well as oral.
And the you're hearing all kinds of interesting things, and the setup is always just fascinating to look at from a purely mechanical perspective. And this work, Paul Dooley, is a composer that lives here in Michigan. So we've got some more homegrown talent here.
That's great.
And Lisa actually brought the work to my attention, and I said, well, I knew Paul's music and have always thought really highly of it. I think he's a terrific composer, so we're excited about that premiere.
Under your leadership this past decade, Tim, the Lansing Symphony has seen increased attendance at its concerts and an overall strengthening of its financial outlook. Where does the organization stand currently in terms of its finances?
Healthy. I mean, running a nonprofit organization, especially one as large as this, in difficult economic times is challenging. I have a great partner in this business in Courtney Millbrook. We have an extraordinary staff that is able to make things happen that are amazing to me, both on the development side and just on the running of the organization. We're always worried, but we manage our money very well. And so I think we're healthy, we're robust, we're always working on that. That's a work in progress, maintaining the fiscal stability of a large nonprofit these days is always a work in progress.
Timothy Muffet, thanks for being with us on Current State, and thank you for all you've done for the Lansing Symphony Orchestra and the Lansing community.
Thank you, Jody. It's been my pleasure.
You can hear Jody Knowles' complete 22-minute interview with Maestro Timothy Muffett online at wkar.org. The two go into even more depth about the Lansing Symphony Orchestra's upcoming season, including the chamber music, pops, and jazz band concerts. That's our show for today. We are taking a break for a couple of days. You can hear some of our best interviews and segments tomorrow in an encore edition of Current State. And then be sure to join us Saturday morning here on 90.5 or in person as we return to broadcast live from the East Lansing Art Festival right in front of East Lansing City Hall on Abbott Road. It's an all music hour of Current State. Catbird Seat, Moxie Strings, and the fabulous Heftones perform between 11 and noon here on Current State. That's Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the program today. Thanks also to producers Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to engineer Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Politics, education, environment, news, music, theater. Catch it at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's Current State from WKAR.